thank you for tuning in today. I'm Henrik. The website is redeyescreations.com, and you are listening to Red Eyes Radio, an independent radio program that addresses many of the subjects that we find to be interesting, important, but also too controversial or too hot for some to handle. We do try to do what we can when it comes to deprogramming us from the crippling tyranny of political correctness that successfully has managed to impose so much self-censorship on many people. Even if it's only for the sake of smashing some sacred cows like there were some swollen beef piñatas or something, I do think this alone would be a noble endeavor in these times, to be honest. But we are, of course, primarily interested in getting to the truth and widening our understanding of the world and our history. As you know, if you are a regular listener, we don't always agree with our guests, but we do like to challenge your beliefs and what you think you know. This can be the most difficult with those already in the alternative scene, if you will, because they already, of course, have a belief that they are aware and awake, and they already have all the answers and all the truth. And that's why it's so important to reinvestigate and look again to make sure we haven't bought yet another level of the lie, a trapping that has been laid to take us into the wrong direction. It's only when we begin to investigate many of the different facets that we can begin to find our way through the lies towards the truth. And that's why it's important to look into the answers for yourself. Don't take mine or any of our guests' word for it. Come to your own conclusions. There's no harm in asking questions, investigating, or trying to find the answers on your terms, no matter what everyone else says. Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, we have another really heavy topic for you today. We are going to ask some really difficult questions surrounding the future of mankind, the overall health and well-being and intelligence level of our population. Basically, where are we heading? What is our future going to be like if we proceed on our current path or trajectory? The fundamental question we should ask is, do we want to see a positive improvement in our population over time, or do we want to see a negative decline over time? If you, like me anyway, would like to see the first one of those being achieved, then I think that some of the questions that we are going to try to tackle here today and talk more about are some of the points that we are going to have to address at some stage if we intend to continue to push human civilization upwards and onwards. Eugenics versus dysgenics, that is the question. The definition of dysgenics is the genetic deterioration of a population or populations and the study of such processes. Another would be degeneration in offspring or the accumulation and perpetuation of defective or disadvantageous genes and traits in offspring of a particular population or species. In dysgenics, genetic deterioration in modern populations, Professor Richard Lynn presented some compelling evidence that much of the world is deteriorating in its genetic potential for intelligence, health, and conscientiousness, or good character. We are going to consider the material, the research, and the numbers that are suggesting that we are, at present time, evolving to become less intelligent with each new generation. As more intelligent people are having fewer children, and less intelligent people are having more children. This is dysgenics, the opposite of eugenics, whether we like it or not. So what if that is true? Can this be turned around? How can we improve and advocate for solutions for the betterment of the human race when these questions are taboo? If we don't do something about this, what are our future generations going to be like? We are going to hear from someone today that is advocating something that is probably one of the most misrepresented, misunderstood, and also, I'd say, despised fields that you can imagine. Yet our guest will tell you that it's one of the most pressing and urgent questions that there is if we are concerned about our future. It's one of these topics that are completely demonized. You've only been told one side of this field, I bet. And I'd say there is almost complete cohesion due to how the priest class has colonized our minds and told us what we should think about what we've learned and studied about ourselves. So since there is little to no discussions about this, I wanted us to discuss it and bring it up. We'll go into the benefits of eugenics today and talk about the effects of raising the IQ of the population and how our genetic endowment for intelligence is unfortunately rapidly decreasing. Have we gotten the full story on eugenics? Perhaps it is dysgenics that is being encouraged today. We are going to talk about the anti-eugenics hoax that is going on today. Our guest is Marion Van Koort. She is an independent scholar who has published many papers on eugenics, and she is the founder of the website Future Generations. Eugenics.net is the address. She has conducted original research on IQ and fertility and was first to discover the presence of dysgenic fertility in the U.S. for most of the 20th century. Some of her papers include The Case for Eugenics in a Nutshell, also The Massive Anti-Eugenics Hoax Uncovered, a Radical New Interpretation of the History of Eugenics, and Against Good Breeding, Understanding Jewish Opposition to Eugenics. I wanted to read from her website here a small section that explains a bit of what we'll go into here today before we get started. Quote, Future Generations is about humanitarian eugenics. Humanitarian eugenics strives to leave a genuine legacy of love to future generations, good health, high intelligence, and noble character. We advocate measures to improve the innate quality of humankind, which are entirely voluntary. Please be forewarned that most ideas expressed on this website are, quote, politically incorrect, unquote. We aspire to total honesty, believing that it is the only policy for people with integrity. And furthermore, that in the long run, honesty is far and away the most compassionate policy. If we ever hope to solve the problems which face our species, it's imperative that we first look at them objectively and assess the scientific evidence without bias. If the truth about genetics and behavior, about eugenics, or about race is considered taboo, and falsehood are the only socially acceptable opinions, then this is truly a sad state of affairs, but we won't let it deter us. Unquote. So in this program, we are not going to tackle or address the more common alternative media conspiracies, if you will, of the application of eugenics. I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of those arguments already, and we have done plenty of shows on that in the past, so we'll save that for another time with our guest. There is a lot about the various individuals and institutes that have founded the movements, but also keep in mind that there is a definition change, I believe, that has occurred here, and I would say that the programs promoted by the globalists, the elite, parasites, whatever you want to call them, is not eugenics, but dysgenics. It's clear to me that with this application, they could very well create a subspecies that are very easily controlled, less intelligent, prone to disease, and becomes pretty much a ward of the state, dependent on perpetual healthcare services provided by the pharmaceutical monopoly cartels. It seems that what Bill Gates, the Rockefellers, and all these people are up to is dysgenics, not eugenics. But again, we're not going to address that particular question in this program. A final thought for you here that you can consider before we begin. What's strange about all of this is, who would not want to improve themselves and wish something better for both themselves, but also for their children and for their people, to see an increase in intelligence over time, to break into new territory, discoveries, break new records, to have us achieve in the future things we could only dream of today. Who would want to see a future where we regress as opposed to improve? If dysgenics has detrimental effects and cause more suffering, then could it be possible that at the root of eugenics is a desire to diminish suffering, and that any person who cares about other human beings, alleviating suffering and concern for the future of civilization and the human race, should think about and confront these kinds of questions? If we know that we are doing something wrong today, something that will lead to detrimental effects in the future, well, should we do something about it, or should we turn our heads, pretend that it isn't real and avoid it, or hope someone else will sort it out for us just because it's simply too painful for us to deal with it at this stage? I would say that, if I understand the material that Marion brings to the table, then this topic is the ultimate expression of tough love, if there ever was one. But Marion is very outspoken about her findings and the research she has done over the years. She does speak her mind, and she tells it like she sees it. And we'll listen to what she has to say today. I think she's very brave to speak out on these very controversial subjects. And I think you know by now that we don't cater to those who are easily offended. We want to go where the research has taken our guests and give them a chance to explain the issues that are tremendously misrepresented in the mainstream avenues. But nonetheless, I hope that this program could be a tiny step in the direction of better understanding the subject from a different point of view. Okay, well, that's enough of me. Thank you for listening to my rant. I just wanted to share some thoughts with you here before we begin. But without further ado, let's hear what our guest has to say. Let's get going. Welcome, Marianne. Very glad to speak with you today. Thank you for spending some of your time with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, you bet. This is going to be very interesting. I've been interested in this subject for a while since I read a couple of articles of yours, and I think they're very good. You make a very good case, and I wanted to bring you on to give you an opportunity to talk about something that we seldom do hear about on this particular topic. Why don't you tell us first how you became interested in eugenics?
Well, when I was 12 years old, I was just sitting in the den, staring into space, and my father walked into the room, and he says, "Well, Marion, are you aware of the fact that human intelligence is largely hereditary?" And so I thought about it for a second, and this is long before political correctness, of course. So I thought about it. I said, "Yeah, I agree that it's hereditary." And he says, "Now, the problem is that the smartest people are having the fewest children. And so generation after generation, we get stupider and stupider." And I was just appalled. You know, I thought, this is the worst thing. And I looked out the window, and these people are, you know, these kids are riding their bikes and skating along. And I thought, gee, the whole world should just, you know, stop what it's doing and set this straight, you know, because it's so awful. And so anyway, this kind of receded into my memory. And then when I was an undergraduate at UC Berkeley, I learned in psychology class that it is, in fact, true that intelligence is largely hereditary. There is an environmental component, but it's mostly hereditary. And we know this because twins separated at birth are extraordinarily similar on IQ. And also kids who are adopted resemble their biological parents in IQ when they're grown, but they do not resemble their adoptive parents.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. It's a very interesting, a lot of those studies where even some behavioral patterns have been picked up and seems to be part of the genetic makeup as opposed to the environment. But so basically you went on to try to prove what your father had told you and you went on to try to you know, figure this out, right?
Well, I didn't really, you know, when you're a kid, you're told all kinds of stuff like Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. So I didn't really take it all that seriously. I was appalled at the time, but then I forgot about it. But when I got to college and realized that intelligence really is hereditary, and it looked to me, from going to the grocery store and walking around town and doing different things, I just felt like the smartest people were having the fewest children. It was a casual observation. It was not necessarily, you know, I couldn't bank on it. But I had the great good fortune to get a data set. This is when I was in graduate school at the University of Texas in Austin. I had the great good fortune to get a fantastic data set called the General Social Survey, which has it has a little bitty IQ test, which is not at all useful for diagnostic purposes for an individual, but it's intended for large studies just like mine. And it had also the number of children and all kinds of other variables. So I was able to look at the relationship between IQ and number of children for most of the 20th century in America. And this was so exciting because all of the previous studies that had attempted to answer this question were methodologically flawed. And so this was the first really good, really big, methodologically sound study of that question. And it showed that, in fact, there were negative correlations for cohorts all the way through the 20th century. I mean, well, just to give you an example, in my data set, it showed that we've lost 3.6 points IQ. But if you later did a study with Richard Lynn, so we included some more years. And anyway, if you say from 1850 to almost the present, we've lost over 5 IQ points. And that seems like a small amount, but when you apply that to a distribution, it means you're going to have 5 times as many retarded people and 1/5 the number of gifted, which is over 130. So this difference, I mean, it's not that we're going to have dysphenic fertility. It's not that we're going to start losing IQ. We already have, and we already are.
Right, yeah. Well, I think we can see that, to be honest, in the world. But, you know, a lot of people are afraid of eugenics, I think primarily due to the association that it has today. And I personally believe that this is intentional. But, you know, that's also partially due to the fact that people confuse dysgenics for eugenics. And we'll get to that a little bit later in the program here, Mariam. But do you want to give us a definition first? What is eugenics?
Yes. Okay. There have been many different definitions of eugenics, but the one thing they all have in common is the belief that that the world would become a much better place if healthy and intelligent people had the most children. And it's just an absolutely, you know, logical, sensible, it's common sense, really, because we know that intelligence and health have a huge genetic component, and they're enormously important for civilization and people's well-being. And so in the bell curve, Herstatt and Murray wrote about what would happen when you have a 3-point decline in IQ, and they listed all these social problems that would increase. Every social problem is correlated with IQ. So that the people in prison, for example, have a considerably lower IQ than average. People who are illiterate, people who never graduate from high school, people who are on welfare, people who are unemployed chronically, or, you know, all social problems have a correlation with IQ.
Right.
So what we're talking about, it's not just a scientific, interesting little factoid. You know, it's
right.
Not like it's not like what it, because it applies to everything.
It has real effects in the real world. That's what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Real people, as a result of dysgenics, which is the opposite of eugenics, that means that we're getting stupider because of reproductive, you know, patterns. Dysgenics causes a huge amount of misery. I mean, just plain misery. All these people, for example, who are in prison, they're not happy people, okay? And the people who are unemployed, the people who can't hold a job, you know, the people who are just, they can't read, they're not, you know, these are not happy people. And not only that, they cost society a huge amount of money.
Now, I want to ask you more about that later in terms of, you know, how people end up there. You know, I know a lot of people think, you know, it's not their fault, etc. We'll get to some of those questions later, but I just want to hear things from your perspective here first before we, you know, tackle some of these other more difficult questions. But you wrote an article called The Case for Eugenics in a Nutshell. Why don't we just kind of run through some of those points for people so they know what you're talking about when you're talking about eugenics?
Sure. Okay. Well, I made like 5 points. It's like an argument. It's sort of like a lawyer type argument. And I made 5 points, and then I have a conclusion, which is number 5. Number 1, human intelligence is largely hereditary. As I mentioned, we know this because of the twin studies. And it's not just one twin study. It's like, you know, dozens of twin studies. They all are in agreement. So it's not, some people try to discredit Sir Cyril Burch. So as if that negates all the twin studies. But it doesn't make any difference what Cyril Burt did, whether he's, you know, honest or not honest, because all the other psychologists have come up with the exact same thing. Okay? And so anyway, human intelligence is largely hereditary. Civilization depends upon innate intelligence. And I think that you can look around the world and see different levels of civilization. So we don't have to think back about ancient civilizations. We can look around the world right now. And, for example, in Japan, they have a slightly higher average IQ, like about 105, and they have an extremely orderly society with very little crime. And if you left a bag of money on a park bench, it would sit there for a while, and then somebody would turn it into the police. So, I mean, that's 5 points difference. So, I mean, that's a pretty big deal. And then if you look at someplace like Mexico, the crime rate is huge there. It's horrible. And then even worse, it would be Africa. So that's what different level of civilization means. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Because if we don't have civilization, then might makes right. And suffering is much greater because we don't have, restraint. We don't have laws and people acting in normal ways, cooperating and so on. Okay. Well, anyway, then the third point, the higher the level of civilization, the better off the population. Well, that I think I pretty much covered that. Like, civilization is not an either-or proposition. It's a matter of degree. And every degree up or down matters. It matters to real people. Okay. Number four, at the present time, we are evolving to become less intelligent with each new generation. And we know this because of my research, which I've done with the General Social Survey that I just described. And then I did, along with Richard Lynn, who's the most famous and eminent eugenicist in the world. He and I did a study together, which we published in the journal Intelligence, which looked over a lot of the same data, but had some more recent data. And it found exactly the same thing. So there have been two studies that have found this, and they were both, they both used samples that were extremely well done. In other words, random samples of a large number of people. Okay, and then number five says, unless we halt or reverse this trend, our civilization will invariably decline.
Mm-hmm.
And any decline in civilization produces a commensurate increase in the collective misery quotient. And so, I mean, that's any person who cares at all about other human beings and about alleviating suffering, certainly any religious person, but even a person who's an atheist, if you care about other people and you care about suffering, then this is hugely important. And it's being completely ignored. So,
yeah, why is that, do you think? Why is it being not discussed if we know these things, if we scientifically have been able to come to these conclusions? It's definitely not something that's recognized.
Okay, the reason it's being ignored is because the word eugenics and the whole concept of eugenics has been trashed ever since World War II. It's been, there's been a propaganda movement to discredit eugenics and to make everybody think that eugenics was the ideology of the Holocaust and that eugenics is so horrible and dangerous that it should be banned everywhere. And so I'll go into, I guess I might as well launch into some explanation of how this came into being.
Because, yeah, sure.
It's a complicated and very controversial, but really interesting subject, I have to say. Okay, for a long time, I didn't know what the hell was going on because I thought, why are these people telling everybody that eugenics is evil? I mean, what is the matter with these people? And, like Stephen Jay Gould and Rose and Lewontin and Kamen and all these people, they would write books and articles and give lectures and so on. And I couldn't understand because I didn't believe that they were so dumb as to believe what they were saying. You understand what I'm saying?
Yep.
I believe they were lying. I believe that from way back. But I couldn't understand why they would care. Why do they even want to do this? And so just last year, I mean, I've been totally committed to eugenics since I was like 22. I'm now 66. Okay. So I spent my whole life working on eugenics. And just last year, I figured out what's going on.
Right.
That is that I read this book. It's a friend of mine named John Glad wrote a book called Jewish Eugenics. And he was trying to say that Jews ought to, you know, they ought to approve of eugenics. And he said that Jews have practiced eugenics since ancient times. I've known that. Everybody's known that. And right now in Israel, they have a eugenics program, and they've had eugenics in Israel since the founding of the country in 1948. So John Glad wrote this book, tried to convince the Jews to change their belief. And in this book, he says that over in the 1960s, there was a massive about face among Jewish academics and journalists. They turned 180 degrees from, you know, approving of eugenics to vehement denunciation of eugenics. And so you think to yourself, well, what the hell, why is this happening? This is crazy.
Right.
And so anyway, and then you realize from reading John Glad's book that, first of all, this 180 degree thing was just a total revelation to me, because I had never heard of such a thing. But also the fact that virtually all of the anti-eugenicists are Jews. I'm not saying every single one, but almost, you know what I mean? Like overwhelming majority of the anti-eugenicists have been Jews.
Do you think it would be fair to say this, that a lot of people who are anti-eugenicists today, they can be all different races and cultures and religions and colors, what have you. But if we talk about the kind of the dialogue that's been going on in the background that have shaped this opinion, then you're talking
exactly.
About Jewish people. For example, you have The Mismeasure of Man by Stephen Jay Gould. In the Name of Eugenics, Genetics and the Use of Human Heredity by Daniel Kivlis, I think his name is. And a lot of these works have been kind of questioned by a lot of academics as well, I believe.
Yeah, that's very well said, that they are the spearhead of the whole thing. And then it trickles down to people who they don't know any better, so they just go along with whatever somebody else tells them.
Mm-hmm.
But that's exactly right, that they're the ones who started this whole thing and provided the impetus for it. And so you have to think to yourself, well, why are they telling everybody in the West that eugenics is evil and it'll cause genocide?
Right.
Why are they telling people this?
Yeah.
Now, if you, I really, this is a great stroke of luck. I ran into this article maybe 20 years ago, but I still remember it. And so that was, you know, it's wonderful how I can file these things away in my mind and remember them. But of course, I can never find my car keys, you know, but I just, I've got like a storage of all these articles. Anyway, there was an article about eugenics then and now, or something like that, by some woman. It was published in around 1935, maybe 1935. Anyway, she talked about all these eugenics programs all over the world. And so altogether, there were about 28 countries that had eugenics. And if we even grant that the Holocaust took place like we're, you know, supposed to believe, I mean, this is questioned now, I realize that, but I'm just saying, just for the sake of argument, let's just accept that. Then what you've got is, you've got one country, which is Nazi Germany, in which there's genocide, and 27 other countries in which there's no genocide.
Right, yeah.
And you cannot logically conclude that it causes genocide if it's one out of 28. That's just, you know, one out of 28 does not a correlation make. It's nothing. And in fact, you could even make a stronger case that eugenics prevents genocide. But the point is that it's totally false and nonsense to try to claim that eugenics causes genocide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we'll need to talk a little bit more about that a little bit later here in terms of what it is and what it is not. And there are certain things that's been associated with it, which I believe are actually not part of the concept. But obviously, a lot of people see it as something evil because it's something that they're told it's been forced. It's been through coercion. It's something that I think even in Israel, for example, if you take that example, there have been, I think, sterilization of a large black population in Israel, for example. And there are a number of these kinds of examples. I can just mention another one and we see if you want to comment on that. But that's the case of Sweden, my country, that Sweden used to sterilize people, particularly women, all the way up to the 70s, I think. And we've all been told for a very long time, we did in school anyway, I'll remember that clearly, that we all should feel tremendous shame, even those, of course, who had nothing to do with this. But I'm not familiar with each individual case or on what basis the decisions were made or who made them. But, you know, when I read your article on this, I came to realize that this was done not because the people who did it was evil and wicked, frothing at the mouth with joy over destroying someone's life. There was a reason why they did this.
Oh, absolutely.
So today we look down on an approach that favors overall improvement among a people, which is quite interesting, actually. But you had situations where, for example, you had women who were fertile, who lacked the intelligence. Perhaps they were mentally retarded. Perhaps they lacked the ability to make intelligent, wise decisions, even maybe lacking the ability to make decisions at all. And it was determined, because I believe this happened now and then, that these women could be taken advantage of sexually by unscrupulous men. Children might, of course, have been a consequence of these dishonorable actions by these men. Perhaps some were raped as well, horrible actions. But ultimately, the consequence of this would have ended up in the hands of someone else if a child was born. So what I learned is that this was done so that primarily the immense suffering of that child, of a child born in this and under these conditions, could be prevented. This child might grow up without a mother, or inherit the retardation itself, whatever ailment the mother or father was suffering from. She might have other problems that I hope no one would wish on another. But sure, it is a gamble, as always. But as I understand it, they did this not to inflict pain and suffering on these women, but that's kind of what we're being told today. But they did it so that both the society and other people and the overall health and intelligence of the population could be improved as opposed to be in decline. And I think that's understandable. I mean, if there are women that are not in a position where they would do a good job at taking care of the child they carry, the nature of the state at that time was, okay, you know, should we prevent this from happening then? Can we take that decision now as opposed to leaving this up to chance? Or should we let it go and take the risk that these women not end up in situations where they get pregnant and these children will either be raised by the state or by a mother that can hardly take care of, you know, herself, much less these children. And that the possibility that these traits then continue to thrive and spread. I mean, I understand how they were thinking. They didn't have the luxury then, as we do now, to have a mentality that we can take care of everyone, always, endless, you know, dependency system, endless welfare systems and support that, ultimately leads to endless debt. They were a bit closer, I think, to nature and to the experience of hardship than we are today. And I think they knew that they would have to try to prevent the dysgenics effects within their population. So should this be discussed? Yes, it should. Should it be demonized? I don't know. Should they be demonized for their decision just because our value system has been altered today? No, I don't think so. I think the question is it wrong for a people to try to improve themselves, their overall health, and encourage intelligence and healthy people to have more kids? I do think it's a very dodgy area when you do have government and state in a position to handle this. But, you know, if we have the basic understanding that some kids need special help in school and needs to be separated from the rest so that we can give them, you know, better education, for example, right? I mean, if we have that understanding, then we do have the comprehension skills still to draw a line and recognize that there are differences and we have to adapt to those accordingly. But, you know, we're so far away from that today in our, you know, PC programmed world. But anyway, I just thought that this whole segment and this whole issue that you brought up in your article was a very interesting point to the discussion that I never heard about. It was never presented to me as a reason to the, quote, madness, unquote, that we hear about when it comes to Sweden's Nazi past, right? Well, I'm being facetious here, but this is the kind of silly discussion that goes on about this today, that if you want to improve yourself or if you consciously want your children to have a better starting point in life than you, that if you want to improve yourself or your line, if you want to have many healthy, clever, intelligent children, then, you know, you're running some kind of Nazi breeding program. I mean, that's the images that this kind of discussion conjures up for many, because this is what the media have programmed them to think. But sorry for my rant here, but what would you say about these kinds of policies that were in place in countries as a way to diminish anguish, pain, and suffering, as opposed to perpetuating that cycle?
Exactly. Well, in every country, you're going to have some people who are mentally, either they're mentally retarded or they're psychotic. I mean, there are always going to be some people who are not able to take care of themselves, and they certainly would not be able to take care of a child. And so for men, they can hardly ever get a sexual partner if they're, like, psychotic or retarded. They try, but they just can't figure out how to do it. Because women don't appreciate them very much. But for the women, if they're, like, an institution, say, for retarded people or psychotic people, the guards and the attendants and the people who work there are perfectly happy to take advantage of them. I mean, I don't mean this happens frequently, but it does happen for sure.
Yeah.
And then the baby will be born, and the baby cannot be raised in an insane asylum. So, you know, it cannot stay with its mother. And so it has to be taken away. Now, even if the mother's retarded or whatever, I think it would be a traumatic experience to give birth to a baby and then somebody comes and just says, well, you can't have it because you're crazy, you're stupid, or whatever. I mean, I think that's cruel. And so to prevent that from happening, women can have a tubal ligation, which is, thousands and thousands of women have that every year so that they won't be fertile anymore. It's not like it's some kind of torture or something. And the fact is that people act like, this is true in America too, there are some states where they're still giving reparations to people who have been sterilized. And I would like it if the person who was sterilized and explain, like in one paragraph, why they're mad about being sterilized. Just say something, anything. Or talk up, I don't care what they talk about. But I think that if they did, it would be apparent just within one or two sentences, this person is not normal, you know. I mean, when somebody's really flipped out, they can't make a coherent summary of something. But anyway, what makes me mad is the fact that everybody acts like, oh, this is so horrible. Oh, we've been so mean to these people. But you're not depriving them of motherhood. I mean, the experience of having a child and having it grow up and you love it and it loves you and you watch it go off to school and all this stuff, you're not depriving these women of motherhood because they're already deprived of that because they can't take care of another human being if they can't even take care of themselves.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, and most women, if you ask them, well, what about the experience of pregnancy and childbirth? That's not that great, you know.
Well, some have, apparently.
So, you know.
I'm a guy, what do I know, right? So there are obviously going to be shades. Well, I guess we could tackle this right away as we're in this territory now. But there will be different. There is a scale here, if you will, where you could have people who are more or less coherent, shall we say, while others will be, not at all kind of aware of their surrounding and things like this, and they might still be in a position where they're able to have children. And we live in a very different world today, of course, where we consider it to be everyone's, kind of right or whatnot, that this is, if something like this was done, it would be basically to remove and diminish their opportunity to have this experience, childbirth and raising a child and all that stuff, right? But I think the main crux of this would be possibly on the question of forced versus voluntary, and on the issue of who would come to conclusions about other people, whether they are fit or unfit to have children. Is this something you've thought about?
Yeah, I have, but I haven't really thought about it in great detail because we're so far from formulating a policy because people don't even understand the potential power and kindness of eugenics. They don't understand this at all. It's like Pavlov's dogs. You say eugenics and they think, oh, that means mass murder of the stupid people, or, they don't know what it means. But anyway, I haven't gone into detail about formulating the policy, but I do think that some people talk about using IQ as a measure, but I don't even think that's the best way to go. I think if somebody has a low IQ but can support himself or herself and shows reasonably good judgment about, making sure the child has enough to eat, I wouldn't be in favor of having that person sterilized. But see, here's the problem. The retarded in general, not necessarily all, but in general, make very poor parents. And it's been shown that, for example, they just, the kid might have a festering sore or some kind of, vomiting or whatever, and they don't really see the need to take the child to the doctor. And so
in other words, it's about spreading that the pain and suffering of this child, obviously, is something that would either then continue, or it would end up in the responsibility would end up in the hands of someone else. That's basically the two options we have here, right?
That's right. In other words, it could start off, you take away the baby from the mother, or you could leave the baby with the mother until you see that this is a terrible situation. The house is filthy. The kid doesn't have anything to eat. It's got rickets or scurvy or whatever. I mean, but I'm just saying that there is, it's not an easy question. And I think that a great deal of consideration needs to be given to, which criteria would be used in making these decisions. It's not a simple question, really.
No, I understand that. And I don't want to put words in your mouth here, so please clarify for me, but I wanted to mention something else here. So if this is a case of a trajectory, looking ahead of time and to a certain extent having cold application of science upon this problem, which you said others have detailed, where they said that there's an overall decline in IQ among the human species. This basically means that if we follow through on this, we might end up in a society where we have, for example, dependency of a lot of children on society, onto other people, maybe even where decisions haven't really been made by these individuals to have kids to begin with, but it's more or less an accident. So if we look at the long-term projection of that, you would have a tremendous amount of time, effort, resources, economy, etc., burdening the society to be able to deal with the problem, which basically hasn't really been decided upon. It's kind of like an effect of something. So you're saying that if we refuse to tackle this question at some point, and preferably sooner than later, instead of, as we're largely doing now, turning the other way, we don't want to talk about it because it's uncomfortable or whatever. But where will we end up, do you think, if we refuse to address this question and look at it with not perhaps so much emotion, but more of a kind of a cold application of what we know, and make a rational assessment of the situation. Where will we end up if we don't do that?
Okay. I've stated in, I don't know, some papers that I've written, I can't remember, that each person can just imagine, like, for example, in Sweden, you could imagine, let me think, I started to say Italy, but Italy's not a bad place. And people in Europe and America can imagine living in Mexico. And, you know, that is such a, it's a very chaotic place. I mean, I've only been there once, but I have a friend who goes there a couple times a year. And the crime is just unbelievable. And everybody's scared, and, you know, it's just like chaos. And so that's what we would be like. We would be like, okay, and all these social problems, like crime, we're going to have way more crime. And, oh, I'll just digress briefly and tell you about a terrific study that Richard Lear did. He studied the fertility of criminals in London. And ordinarily, demographers don't even look at extreme lower class of men, their fertility, because they figure the men don't even know who their children are. I mean, they tend to be really promiscuous, and they don't hang around long, and so the estimates of their children are inaccurate. They're way understated. But anyway, Richard Lynn did a study of the fertility of London criminals. And he found that despite lengthy sojourns in prison, and despite the fact that when they tell you how many children they have, it's going to be an underestimate of the true number, they still had more children than the average Londoner.
Right. Hmm.
And he calculated that the heritability, well, he did a formula that would show the percentage of increase in crime to be expected from this one fact, all other things being equal. You follow me?
Yep.
Don't you think that's cool? I just think that was one of the coolest studies I ever read.
Right, right.
But there are so many correlates of IQ. Like, for example, I'll tell you some of the positive correlates. Height, nearsightedness. That nearsightedness is the only bad one. You know, being slender as opposed to being obese. Law-abidingness, long life, achieving, you know, high levels of education, making a lot of money. Actually, honesty. There's a little bit that, you know, people who are very, you know, who are intelligent are somewhat more honest. And there's a whole long list of things. I mean, mm-hmm. It's just, and so they're all good things, because if you think about how much money it costs, they say in America it costs the same amount to keep a prisoner for 1 year in jail as it does to send the child to Harvard. So you think about, in America, we have somebody, I think on the news, they said 1 million people in jail. It sounds like a lot, but maybe that's true. Well, anyway, we have a whole lot of people in jail here. And it's a good thing, too, because if they weren't in jail, they would be out there, you know, commit more crimes. But the point is that these people, first of all, they're not happy. Their families are not happy. They're costing a huge amount of money, and it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, you've got all these social scientists running around and all kinds of other people and do-gooders and so on trying to figure out, well, what are we going to do about crime? What can we do? We need to give little children in housing projects. We need to give them more books to read, and we need to do this. We need to do that. Everybody's just, you know, and why is it they're trying to figure out what to do about why some children don't do well in school? And nobody's ever suggested maybe it's because they're not very bright, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's That's one big reason why kids don't do well in school. It could be something else. It could be because they're unhappy at home or they're not having malnutrition or whatever. But so all these problems, everybody's pointing fingers at every other problem as the cause. And then when in reality, there's one mega cause underlying the whole wretched bunch of social problems.
Yeah, because people have, people end up in prison, whatever. It's not their fault, right? It's always society's fault. It's a socioeconomic problem. We need to put more money into these efforts. But that's not really what's the fundamental issue here. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah. And when I first heard about conjugal visits, boy, did that make me mad. Because that's the last thing we need. So anyway,
I want to ask you more about that. Who you think is behind if you view that issue? But again, I wanted to go back to something here and I guess clarify to a certain extent to see if I'm understanding it correctly. But it's basically a decision that you consider that we need to approach this now, despite that it's being a difficult one and a tough question to approach for many different reasons, as you just said, but. Ultimately, you're saying it's something that actually is based in compassion for mankind, as opposed to
exactly.
Being something which is evil and wicked. And this is of
exactly.
course done. It's about not letting an issue that we have the brains to deal with not to get out of hand, ending up in a world where we have a lot more suffering, social problems, economic woes, and all kinds of slur of issues that occurs consequently due to the fact that we're refusing to address this fundamental question. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, that's very fair and well said. I mean, I agree with exactly what you just said. When you think about the fact that they have deliberately perpetrated this anti-eugenics hoax and knowingly degraded the populations of North America and Europe in terms of health, intelligence, all kinds of stuff. It's the most vicious, it's the most unbelievably vicious thing imaginable. I just, it's hard for me to even see how people could do something so cruel on such a vast scale.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think it is that people with higher IQ have fewer children?
Okay, the main thing is, the main problem is that women with low IQ have way more accidental pregnancies. And the reason for this is that they tend to have sex more and earlier and then they tend to not use birth control. And if they do use some sort of birth control, they don't use it consistently and effectively. So they get pregnant way more often than they intend to and that they want to. And then some of them will have an abortion, but some of them don't. But if we could simply make sure that everyone, all women, had the number of children that they actually wanted to have, so that we had contraception for everybody and abortion in case contraception doesn't work, we could break even genetically so that we wouldn't be losing ground, we wouldn't be gaining ground, but we wouldn't be losing any ground.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why in America, we have these two camps. There's the pro-life camp and the pro-choice camp that has to do with abortion. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay. Well, that's why eugenicists are in the pro-choice camp, because if you create a situation where, like right now, this is a disaster in America because the Republicans are getting control of various states in the country, especially in the South. And so when they get control of the state, what do? They start shutting down all the abortion clinics. You know, and the clinic is a woman's clinic, so it means it's for contraception, abortion, also to check for cancer, like breast cancer, whatever. And so they're just drastically reducing the number of clinics because they think, oh, well, this way we won't have as much abortion because they're religious fanatics, you know, and morons, really. But see, what the effect of that is that smart women are always going to get contraception. You know, smart women, they have resources, they have a car, they have money in the bank. I mean, if they don't have any, they'll ask somebody they know. Let me borrow some money. I need to have an abortion, you know. But anyway, unintelligent women often don't have a car. They don't have any money. And so if you start, you know, shutting down all these abortion clinics or women's clinics, then they can't get any contraception and they can't get an abortion. So they end up having lots more children. And it's extremely dysgenic.
So it's about having children when you want to have children. That's something that doesn't occur too much in today, right?
Well, I just think that it really is upsetting because these pro-life people, they're very sanctimonious and self-righteous. And what they're doing is spreading misery.
Let me ask you, it might sound perhaps a bit vicious here, but basically, if we had a situation where we lived closer to nature or backed up, maybe a few hundred years or maybe even a thousand, maybe even more, whatever, there would be a scenario where, for various reasons, people who were not clever enough would more likely not survive certain things, outsmart certain predators, maybe not avoid certain situations that got you in trouble for various reasons. Do you think that we've ended up in a situation now where we've kind of removed ourselves from nature, hence natural selection, then, if we can call it that, have been out of the picture for a very long time, meaning that we've been so smart to a certain extent that we managed to disconnect ourselves from nature. But the irony in the situation is that now we're attaining a position here, potentially, then, if we take into account what you're saying here, that will be detrimental to mankind ultimately, in to a certain extent, then dragging us closer back into nature being in control of the situation again. Do you see what I'm saying?
I see what you're saying. I wanted to also make clear the point that it was in the 1800s, the mid 1800s, that books were published which explained how women get pregnant and how they could avoid pregnancy. And also, Goodyear perfected the vulcanization of rubber so they could make condoms and diaphragms. Like I would say, that would be in the mid-1800s. And so people who were smart could read the books and figure out how not to get pregnant. Until that time, up until, say, 1800, we had pretty much natural fertility. So when a couple gets married, they don't use any birth control, and they have large families. But if a man is not smart enough to be able to support a family, he'll never marry. So for that reason, there's a slight positive correlation between number of children and intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But then when contraception comes along, all of a sudden, the smart people think, hey, wow, you know, because who really wants to have 13 children? I don't know. I mean, I guess some people do, but I would say the majority of people don't. And so then contraception comes along, and people look around, and then they realize, and they go, oh, my God, these, you know, there's so much greater fertility among the lower classes. And there is a social class gradient that goes along with the IQ gradient, you know. In other words, well, on average, people of the upper classes are smarter than people of the lower classes because everybody's trying to move up, and then there's selection. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're saying that whether we like it or not, there is an innate competition in whatever system that we have, and those who are either smart enough, or in some cases, I'd say even ruthless enough. But if we look at it with the cold view, not emotionally, we can realize that those people who are in a position to to outsmart others, basically, even if that's for, you know, in a negative sense, that's kind of proof of the fact that they've managed to do something which others have not. They've set themselves apart from the others, and whether we like that or not, it's indicative of the fact that they are different than others. It's not everyone isn't equal if we look at it from that point of view, correct?
Yeah, but it's also not just intelligence. That's a big part of it, is intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And hard work, but it's also, to tell you the honest, I got true good character.
Right, okay.
It's not so much ruthlessness, that might be part of it. But you see, here's the thing. If you have a business where you just, you have a donkey and you have a big wagon, you go from town to town, well, it might be to your advantage to cheat people, okay? But that's very, very rare. But if you actually have a business, in one place, in one town or one city, you really cannot cheat people because you'll get in big trouble. And in other words, it's not, how can I explain this? Being honest is an advantage. And so down at the bottom of the social classes, you've got considerably greater bad character.
I see what you're saying, that it's many different variables that makes us successful. And although I would say personally that we have a kind of a criminal network in charge of many things today, and they're very ruthless, and I don't like that, but the fact is they have managed to outsmart a lot of people. I think we are in the situation we are in now because, frankly, we have a lot of dumbed down and stupid people who don't see that they've been outsmarted, and there we go. So whether we make a value judgment on that or not doesn't really matter. We're in a situation where if we had a lot more smarter people, I think we could make the world a much better place, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. But I don't, a lot of people blame, they say, white men are too wishy-washy, or they're gutless or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they should realize what the Jews have done to us and fight back, okay? Although I don't include just white men, I include white women, because they can fight in their own way with the cast iron frying pan or whatever. But I don't think that what the Jews have done to us is entirely a result of them outsmarting us. Because I think that deviousness and dishonesty are a very big part of it. And by the way, Richard Lynn did a study of values among Jews. Like, you know, which traits do you value the most in your children? This came from the General Social Survey, and I suggested they do it. Because I wanted to see somebody do it, but I didn't want to have to do it myself. But anyway, if the question says, which traits would you like to see in your children? Obedience, honesty, industriousness? Well, there were like about 7 traits that they could choose from.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing, as far as I was, manners was another one.
Yeah.
The Jews scored pretty much exactly like the Protestants or the Catholics, except for on 2 traits. And honesty, they gave lower value to honesty, and they gave lower value to manners.
Hmm.
And I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just would like to go back to this business of the fact that the Jews basically, in my opinion, are ruining the world. I mean, that may sound like a rash thing to say, but that's my opinion.
Okay, yeah. You're free to have it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the thing is that I just, I don't blame us, because we tend to be honest ourselves. And so we're not very suspicious. You know, a person like a criminal is going to be very suspicious of everybody because he's a bum and he thinks everybody else is a bum. But we tend to be sort of naive and childlike and trusting because we ourselves are relatively, compared to them, more honest. And so it's not our bad traits, it's some of our good traits that have gotten us into trouble.
Right.
But the question still remains, what are we going to do about it?
Sure, you know? Sure, yeah.
I mean, if I had some words of wisdom about what to do about it, I'd tell you, but I'm not really. The only thing that's given me some encouragement is Red Ice has given me encouragement, and Countercurrents has given me encouragement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Countercurrents, but, some great articles and great books they release over there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but it's going to have to be. Did you hear the conversation between Greg Johnson and Patrick LeBrun, in which they were talking about entryism and all that stuff?
Not that particular one. I heard another one. We had Patrick LeBrun on the program a while back, but no, I haven't heard that one.
Well, he is. They are both fascinating. But anyway, it was a really interesting conversation. The thing is, like, for example, in Europe, is this true in Sweden that if you are fired, you have to be fired for a job, you have to be fired for a good reason?
Oh, I would say if you hire, you can't fire. That's the slogan in Sweden, pretty much. And I also think that that's one of the reasons why we've seen such a tremendous difficulty when it comes to, for example, immigration population, because the borders are wide open in Sweden. So we get a lot of immigration, but then the social and economic situation we've had in Sweden has been that, you know, they're very highly educated. They know the language well, of course, and these kinds of issues, but we developed a labor policy, which has entailed basically very strong unions, so that if you get, you know, you can hardly fire people, you have to have very good reason. And even then, you know, the unions can pressure the employer and say, you know, this is not right and you can't do this. And that's why I think that many of the employers don't dare to take any chances, for example. So we have a huge schism within our society now, that an increasing immigration population, and then employers don't dare or can't in some cases take a risk. And that's when you get things like our Swedish version of like affirmative action, for example, where the government have to step in and pay part of the salaries to the employers so that they will take these chances and employ more immigrants that might not know the culture or the language or our ways that well. So it's a huge problem, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, LeBrun was talking about how in France, they, you know, have the unions are very strong. And so the problem about free speech there and here is different, because here we have a law saying we have free speech, okay? But if you say the wrong thing, you're going to get fired.
Sure, yeah.
From your job.
That's right.
So you know, what good does it do? It doesn't really do much good. But I don't know whether this is something you want to pursue right now, or maybe it would be better to pursue it with Greg Johnson or some other people who are smarter than I am, like maybe Kevin McDonald or people like that. But I really don't know what we're going to do about this situation, because it just seems like they have such massive, oppressive control right now. And I don't see how we're going to get out of it.
I believe you're right. I think we have tremendous pressures on us for many very, very reasons. And yeah, maybe we can pick up and talk a little bit more about that in the second segment. I want to clarify a little bit more as well in the second, Marian, about what, you know, what eugenics is versus what it isn't. And then, you know, make the comparison with dysgenics and kind of explain that and these fundamental differences. But
okay.
Before we take a break here, though, let's give out your website. You have eugenics.net. That's your main website, and there's a lot of good articles there for people, which I recommend reading if you have questions, if you want to know more about what Marian is talking about and her perspective. She has authored a lot of articles herself, but there's a lot of other people that have written articles as well that's up on that website. Do you have any books or anything like that you'd like to mention to our audience?
I have a book coming out in a couple of months called The Eugenics Manifesto, and it's going to be published by Greg Johnson, and it'll just be a whole book of my essays. I've got a few more that I haven't published yet that I'm going to publish, and then we'll just put it all together and, you know, to one little volume.
Great. Yeah, that's perfect. So in a few months, you think it's going to be out?
Well, it is. We keep saying, "Oh well, it'll just be a couple more months."
Yeah.
But anyway, so I keep telling people it's going to be a couple more months than that. So I don't know how long this is going to go on, but someday it'll be ready. So.
Right. Yeah. we'll keep an eye out for that. And obviously we can link that up once it's up on this program page as well, folks. So if you are listening in the archives, just it might be available in the links. So check it out there. Yeah, we'll pick up after the break here, Marianne. So stay with us. We'll be right back with more.
As the 21st century began, human evolution was at a turning point. Natural selection, the process by which the strongest, the smartest, the fastest reproduced in greater numbers than the rest, a process which had once favored the noblest traits of man, now began to favor different traits. Most science fiction of the day predicted a future that was more civilized and more intelligent. But as time went on, things seemed to be heading in the opposite direction, a dumbing down. How did this happen? Evolution does not necessarily reward intelligence. With no natural predators to thin the herd, it began to simply reward those who reproduced the most and left the intelligent to become an endangered species.
Having kids is such an important decision.
We're just waiting for the right time. It's not something you want to rush into, obviously.
No way.
Oh, shit, I'm pregnant again!
I got too many damn kids! Thought you was on the pill or some shit!
Hell no!
Must have been thinking of Brittany.
Brittany? No, you didn't!
There's no way we could have a child now. Mm-mm. Not with the market the way it is, no.
God, no. That just wouldn't make any sense.
Come on out here, bitch! He don't care about you!
Yeah, well, there must be something he likes over here!
You mean nothing to me, baby!
It wasn't me! It wasn't me!
Well, we finally decided to have children, and I'm not pointing fingers, but it's not going well.
And this is helping.
I'm just saying that before I have in vitro, maybe you should be willing to...
It's always me, right?
Well, it's not my sperm count.
Yeah! I'm gonna fuck all of y'all!
That's my boy!
Cleavon is lucky to be alive. He attempted to jump a jet ski from a lake into a swimming pool and impaled his crotch on an iron gate. But thanks to recent advances in stem cell research and the fine work of Doctors Krinsky and Altshuler, Cleavon should regain full reproductive function.
Get your hands off my junk!
Unfortunately, Trevor passed away from a heart attack while masturbating to produce sperm for artificial insemination. But I have some eggs frozen. So just as soon as the right guy comes along, you know.
And so it went for generations, although few, if any, seemed to notice.
Yeah, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. That's a clip from Idiocracy from 2006. If you haven't seen it before, do take a look. Can recommend it. It's quite funny. And sadly, might turn out to be quite predictable. I hope not. We'll continue to hit some of the hard questions in the second segment as we proceed with Marianne Van Court to hear what she has to say about her work and research. Join us at redicemembers.com. Go there to find all the details. Instant access, close to 1,000 programs on a lot of different topics. We have more programs coming up with Brandon Martinez here next on the ISIS conspiracy. We also speak with Mike Campbell, Brian Anspatrick, Mike Walsh, Patrick Wood, and many more. Thank you for listening. Stay intelligent, and we'll be right back.